everyone, and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, we're listening to a recording from a Modernizing North American Defense Conference, which we held January 29th, 2020. This is the Maritime Dimension to North American Defense panel, which I moderated and featured a conversation with Captain Navy Douglas Campbell, John Sanford, Neil O'Rourke, and Rear Admiral Steve Woodell.
A lot of the discussion around continental defense, NORAD modernization, it tends to focus, because that's been the nature of the discussion and the threat in the past, on air-based threats, missiles, aircraft. But there's an inherent maritime component to all of this. We've got a selection of great speakers here to talk about this from a number of different perspectives. And let me just briefly introduce everybody. To my immediate left, we have Rear Admiral Steve Woodell, who is the Vice Commander of U.S. Second Fleet. Next to him, this is actually almost in the order that I have in my notes, by total fluke, Neil O'Rourke, who is the Assistant Commissioner of the Arctic Region for the Canadian Coast Guard. Next to him, we have Captain Navy Douglas Campbell, who's the Director Naval Major Crown Projects for the RCN. And then at the end of the stage, we have John Sanford from the National Maritime Intelligence Integration Office in the U.S. So we have a number of different viewpoints to get at the maritime piece to continental defense. We're going to start at the end of the stage with you, John. Start us off, because the nature of what your organization does is to paint a maritime domain and intelligence picture. So set the stage by discussing, if you will, what the key maritime threats and issues facing the continent are, and how you are seeing them currently factor into American defense and security thinking going forward as we're thinking about continental defense.
Dang. That's a lot. So I'll do like the general did and just make up stuff as I go along. That's what he told me to do. So I appreciate the opportunity today. My organization down in Washington, D.C., we do maritime domain awareness. I thought it was really good that all the lanyards had MDA on there until somebody pointed out it was Missile Defense Agency or something like that. So we look at maritime. We're the national intelligence managers for maritime. And it was interesting hearing a lot of the people talk earlier that feed into a little bit what I'm going to talk about. But, you know, first of all, the word awareness is probably not a good word, because that means you're just aware. 9/11, we were aware of every passenger in the skies, but we didn't know who the bad guys were. We were aware where every aircraft was being tracked, but we didn't know which ones were going to be turned into a weapon. And that could be hybrid warfare. Some people called it asymmetric warfare. So I like the previous, and I don't remember who mentioned it, about, hey, the dots. We need to make sure that we understand. And so the word shouldn't be awareness. It should be an effective understanding. And our national strategy for maritime security says that, to deliver an effective understanding of the maritime domain. And often the maritime domain, we don't have a maritime command like some of the other commands, but we do have the navies and the coast guards have been doing this forever, and so we understand that. But we have to have not just a whole of nation, but a whole of government, but whole of nation, because we have First Nation maritime experts that understand adversaries that are operating their domain that could be a counterintelligence. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the threats that we look at. And if I take just one example of drugs. So in June of last year, there was a Mediterranean shipping company, the Guyane, that was captured down in Philadelphia. And they had 19.5 metric tons of cocaine on there. Now, that's a lot, but how much is that? That's 38 million packets for each user of cocaine. $1.3 billion was the street value. So you would say, when they busted the crewmen and they were being paid $50,000 each to support that, that ship had come into Philadelphia at least three times before, and there was other sister ships. So you'd say, well, how does that affect North American defense? Well, if you're opening up bases in the Arctic, there's a lot of boredom up there, and drugs is a very easy way to get to that. So when you look at that, last year in the United States, we had over 70,000 people died from drug overdose. One in five was cocaine. So if you were to take a city of 70,000 people and had an errant North Korean missile or Chinese ICBM or one of those cruise missiles I've heard about today that blew up that city, it'd be horrific. But when you hear 70,000 plus died of drug overdose, many of which was delivered by maritime means, it doesn't dent our population, you know, thoughts on that. So I would take illicit activities in the maritime domain as one of the primary things that we look at to help support the defense effort.
Switch to a more core conventional surface and subsurface picture and the threat related to that. Admiral, ask you to talk a little bit about Second Fleet and what it's doing, why it was stood up, why you were there as the vice commander and what that means, and effectively why I had to get you up here from Norfolk and not from across town.
And even the U.S. Navy is paying for my TD to be here. So.
Even better.
thanks for the opportunity, Dave, and Colin and CGAI. You know, and it's not lost on me that in this room are a few predecessors who went before me down to Norfolk. You know, Kelly Williams was down there, Norm Jolin I see in the back, whether we're talking about Dusty Miller, Nigel Brodeur back in the 80s. These are all Canadians who have previously worked in Norfolk with our partners, whether in NATO roles or core U.S. Navy roles. And so my arrival, although certainly well-received and, you know, enabled by leadership here, is really nothing new. We've done this before. It's a manifest example of the partnership that has always been there and will continue to do so. But truth be told, it has been a few years since a more senior Canadian officer has been in Norfolk. You know, and I'm mindful of Rob Hubert's point earlier, which he stressed last night and again today, about the reemergence of the Cold War in 2007. You know, it's interesting that it was at that very particular time that the NATO operational footprint in Norfolk essentially disappeared. Whether it was Striking Fleet Atlantic, SAC Lant, Commander-in-Chief West Lant, all of these operational entities in Norfolk disappeared at around the same time when, in fact, we should have been doubling down. And not long after that, Second Fleet disappeared in 2011. CNO John Richardson in 2018 announced the reestablishment of Second Fleet. I think we all know why. Russia near-peer competition is the reason why. But the Second Fleet of today is not the Second Fleet of before. And the Second Fleet of today, smaller, leaner, more agile, with a mission set that is mostly about forced employment, expeditionary operations, and less about what a lot of the other numbered fleets might do, for example, Third Fleet in San Diego with respect to force generation and preparing capabilities to go out the door. So smaller by design, with an intent to be expeditionary. And we've carved that capability out of apparent U.S. Fleet Forces Command, which, truth be told, in an environment where the mission sets over a generation have been overseas in the Middle East, have been in a mindset of preparing forces for deployment on the other side of the globe. And although they have a key role in global force management, allocating those precious resources when and where they need to be, mindful of the force readiness posture that's associated with that. And although they think about operations, they have not, at least until this point, thought about operations from a homeland defense perspective. So Second Fleet is there to help reinforce that with a self-branded identity of being a maneuver arm, whether it's in support of NAVIR in the European theater on the northern flank in the high north towards the Arctic, or whether in support of NAV North for a homeland defense mission closer to the continent. Or in fact, with our symbiotic command by way of Joint Force Command Norfolk, a return of an operational footprint in NATO. My boss is the dual-hatted commander there. One could say that Second Fleet as the maritime component for that Joint Force Command could certainly be activated to do that very mission set. So a branded identity to focus on the high north, defend forward in the GIUK gap potentially, but equally responsive to NAV North requirements in terms of the component command for NORTHCOM to support the mission closer to the homeland. And our mission and my mission to be as the vice commander, although it's interesting, my boss would say, well, we brought you down so that we can learn about the Arctic. Well, I wouldn't brand myself necessarily as an Arctic expert. I'm part of that small population that we heard about this morning that has spent probably about 2 weeks on the ground in the Arctic, although I can say I've sailed, I've flown over, and I've been on the ground in the Arctic, so perhaps that makes me a quote-unquote expert, but what I quickly realized learning and working with my USN counterparts is that they have a zeal to learn more about the North, and they're leveraging my perspectives and at least my limited experience in helping to enable at least the surface fleet to be a little more competent in understanding how they operate in the North. And so that's my role in Second Fleet now, but certainly it's an incredible opportunity to working with our partners, particularly from a homeland defense aperture.
And so that's actually an excellent segue to Neil. And what we wanted to do in bringing you here today, recognizing that the Coast Guard doesn't have explicitly the defense mandate that your counterparts up here do, but you do have the expertise in the North, and you have both today and given the announcements over the past year and a bit, we'll be having more capability to actually operate in those waters. So can you talk a little bit about how the Canadian Coast Guard looks at the role that it will play in continental defense and security?
Sure. I think that, first of all, it's kind of, it depends on how I answer the question depends on how you want to define security. And I think we've heard a little bit over the last day or so that threats aren't the traditional threats that we've seen in the past, which I'll defer to many others in the room who are more the experts in that. But certainly, we see threats now to economic security, environmental security, and many others. And, you know, we work very closely with JTFN out of Yellowknife, and of course, you know, so we have an Arctic Security Working Group, and in fact, we take the broader definition of security in that realm. So that being said, I think there's a couple of different places where there's a common shared interest. So that's kind of around infrastructure and relationships, and I'll elaborate a bit on that. So first of all, you know, when we talk about infrastructure, we've heard a lot today about all the different, from a military or defense perspective, the kind of investments that might be required moving forward. But in a lot of cases, the investments that are required for the defense of the continent are the same investments that are required to better help communities, to ensure safety of marine traffic in the North. And so there's a real advantage collectively for us to work together and seek the right investments for the North that are going to benefit us in multiple areas. And that always makes the sell a little easier than when it's only focused kind of on one specific thing. And I would argue that that's exactly what the Russians are doing. The other thing, so I guess if we talk about a direct security, right, we don't have a defense mandate. That being said, we do have a maritime security program within the Coast Guard. Maritime security in Canada is a shared responsibility amongst multiple departments. We, in fact, have people co-located with some of our federal partners in marine security operations centers across Canada. And what they do is essentially look at the marine domain awareness picture, and you know, as you kind of pointed out, it's about taking that information and actually trying to using it for something and trying to assess, so it becomes actionable intelligence. Now we contribute because we have assets out there, we have AIS equipment, we have radar, we have our ships on the water. So all of those, through all of those different assets, I guess we do collect information that is first and foremost used for us. For safety on the water. However, the same information is beneficial to our security partners. And so that's why Canada does operate these MSOC centers, so that all of us who are collecting information in different ways can bring it to one place. We produce a national maritime picture, which then is used by our more, you know, defense and security type partners within the federal family for the delivery and execution of their mandate. So that's really kind of a direct role that we would have. There's the assets as well. One of the other things that the Canadian Coast Guard has in our mandate, which kind of opens the door fairly wide, is that we are meant to be the civilian fleet that supports the rest of the government. So of course the Navy has their vessels, but in theory, other than the Navy, we're the other fleet for the Government of Canada. So that means that we in fact partner quite often with the RCMP, CBSA, and the delivery of their mandates, and we simply become the delivery platform. Captain of the vessel is still in charge, of course, but otherwise we're doing what the RCMP or other partner are asking us to do. So those are a couple of the kind of direct ways that we I guess help with continental defense. From an indirect perspective, there's the relationships, which I mentioned at the beginning. And so we have a lot of partnerships kind of across the realm, and some of them can be very useful depending on kind of how things move forward, I guess, in continental defense. So first and foremost, we have a lot of international relationships, specifically with the Arctic countries. We're part of the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. We, along with Sweden, are the only two civilian organizations as part of the Arctic Coast Guard Forum. So the other six counterparts that are sitting at the table all have hard security agendas and fit in different places within their countries, armed forces, or intelligence communities. And so from that standpoint, that's again a tool, and I say for Canada, but it's the same with the US. The US Coast Guard sits there with us. And that can sometimes become a tool for diplomacy, depending on circumstances. So as an example, after the invasion of Crimea and sanctions that were put in place, the Arctic Coast Guard Forum continued to meet with the Russians, with the Americans, with ourselves, and all the partners. And sometimes that can be, it could be a possible, useful back channel, diplomatic route if necessary in the future. We also sit as a member, as does the U.S. Coast Guard, on the International AIDS Navigation Lighthouse Authority. Well, it's a mouthful. It's the kind of international body that essentially looks at AIDS to navigation, but in code, also MDA. And so, again, it's focused on safety, marine shipping, economy, but, of course, there are implications on the defense and security side as well. Being a council member there, we have a huge ability to influence other countries around the world on what are the right technologies, what are the right ways forward. Part of that fora includes industry, in fact, and they very much take the lead from what IALA wants to do in that space when they talk about where do they innovate, where do they put their money for R&D, and what kind of equipment do they want to bring to market. So that's another piece. And finally, I would say Inuit relationships. So my job is, in fact, setting up the Arctic region. So yes, I am the assistant commissioner for the region. But we have, in recent times, operated in a three-region model in Canada. And the Arctic region is going to be the fourth. So it's in place, but we haven't necessarily transitioned all the operational responsibilities. That will happen over time in a phased approach. But the big thing that I'm responsible for doing, aside from setting all that up, is building the partnerships, or building on partnerships which have existed, but we recognize need to be strengthened. So that's on the Inuit side. That means working with land claim organizations, individual communities, bringing them into our fold to help deliver our services. We have 16 Coast Guard search and rescue auxiliary units that are Inuit-based in the north. It also means, on the federal family front, closer relationships with JTFN, with the Navy, and with others. And I think, but later we'll talk a bit more about that perspective. I'll maybe leave you with this thought, that as we talk about threats evolving, we see a lot of changes in marine traffic in the north. I think a lot of people in this room are going to be familiar with the science. I think it's been mentioned once or twice, the Shui Long that's come up and done science in the north. And but more importantly for me, I see a huge increase in cruise ships, small cruise ships, adventure tourists, and we have, from a safety perspective, a huge interest in that growing presence in the Arctic. But I would leave you with the thought that that could also turn into a threat at one point as well.
Thanks. So as I mentioned, and we'll come back to this, that you've had over the last year and a bit a lot of announcements about the future fleet capacity for the Canadian Coast Guard. Douglas, what I wanted you to come here and talk to you a little bit is, for the RCN, you've now got pretty good fidelity about the surface fleet renewal for the next, pick your number of decades, for our Navy. Talk a little bit about the capability that's going to come in all of those projects that are now underway, and what that's going to provide in the North American continental context.
Okay, so I'll start by saying I've been back in the country for about 2 weeks. So I just spent a year in Australia, and I must say it's nice to look outside and see bushland that is not full of smoke. And my feelings go for those guys that are still there. But so I came here and I've taken over from some guys who may know SALT. And so I'm responsible for three projects, three PDs, the Joint Support Ship, the Arctic Offshore Patrol Ship, and lastly, and perhaps the one of most importance here, is the Canadian Surface Combatant. So we've all read Strong, Secure, Engaged. We know what the new fleet's supposed to deliver. And I will say that it's not like we're trying to do something revolutionary. It's more evolutionary with the fleet that's being delivered. It's an iterative step in modernization of a fleet that, as the DM made very clear, we have, in the past, we have let things age, and then we replace them. And then we let them age again, and we're replacing them. This is intended not to be like that. The Canadian Surface Combatant project is going to continue delivering ships for a number of years. The Arctic Offshore Patrol Ship project is going to culminate with the sixth vessel, and then there's a seventh and eighth, which the Coast Guard are going to be taking, but they're not the same ship. They're a different ship. And I would say out of those three vessels, you can see that there's improvements done in all of them to what, when you're talking about North American defense, from what we have had in the past. So the Arctic Offshore Patrol Ship, obviously, is a ship that's going to go up into the Arctic and is also going to be able to patrol offshore, filling up a lot of the spaces that used to be done by the Halifax class. But that is the first time in a number of years we're going to have a ship that's actually designed to operate up there. The Canadian Surface Combatant project is a single class replacing two classes, the Halifax class and the Iroquois class. So in it, resident in it, is going to be that ability to command task groups at sea in all the ships. So that gives you a larger ability to become involved in and commanding coalition forces, as well as gathering all the data that a command ship would normally be able to gather. And on the gathering of data piece, it's been mentioned up here already, there is lots of data being gathered, and these vessels will be no different in that they are going to have an increased capability in gathering enormous amounts of data and feeding to that massive data lake that we hope to be able to mine for, you know, using various algorithms in order to come up with, you know, predictive behaviors, et cetera. So it's an exciting thing, a little bit daunting for a guy who's coming back into the project world. But I think that these ships, I think you have to think about them as iterative. Yes, the capabilities are going to be different, but that it is an iterative evolutionary process, not a revolution.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
So Neil, I'll come back to you and ask you to talk a little bit about the fleet renewal that you have now with the fidelity that you've got at this point in time. What changes or enhancements going forward do you think that that's going to provide to what your organization does in the Arctic and in a continental context?
Sure. Maybe just before I touch on that, I don't... Yeah, okay, this seems to be kind of our map. So you'll see on the...
We have too much vitamin D. It makes it hard to see the slides.
It's hard to see, but we do... I will mention just before I talk about the new ships coming online, we have had for many years seven icebreakers that we use in the Arctic. The challenge, of course, like the Navy, same story, so I'm not going to repeat it, is that we, you know, we, and I guess it's more of a Canadian thing, and perhaps I don't think the U.S. is much different, that we wait and then we make the investment. Now, our ships are old. That means, of course, that they have more unplanned maintenance, they come out of service, and they're less reliable. So the first thing that the government did a couple years ago was buy three Viking-class vessels. The first one, the Captain Molly Cool, was in service this year. She sailed the Arctic, delivered on her mandate, and crew were very happy with it, and there were no issues whatsoever. So that's really good news for us. So we still had seven vessels in the north this year. So one of them was in a refit, and then that's exactly the point, was that bringing those three Viking class ships on, we're going to backfill essentially for the other seven ships as we have to take them out, do vessel life extension work and maintenance. So that's kind of the first piece of the puzzle. But then over the last year, so in I guess since May 2019, there have been several announcements or a couple announcements that will really revolutionize our capacity and capabilities from an icebreaking perspective. So the first was an announcement that we were going to be funded for 16 multi-purpose vessels. In our history, if you look, a lot of the vessels have been acquired through circumstance. Some have been purpose-built. Many of them have been bought secondhand, adapted. And so over time, we kind of have a fleet that's a bit of a mix, a mishmash of a bunch of different ships that come from different places. Those of you, of course, that are familiar with ships are going to understand, and probably others as well, that it costs more to maintain, to operate them from a training perspective, everything. It just becomes more expensive and more complicated when you're dealing with a whole pile of different vessels as opposed to a class. So we're now moving in a direction where we're going to have multi-purpose vessels that will be able to deliver on various programs. But one of the most important things is that we're, you know, again, if we look at the life of our current vessels, we're building these ships possibly for 40, 50 years. And none of us know what the environment's going to look like on multiple levels. So these vessels will hopefully be built in a modular way that will give adaptability. So if future governments want to adapt a mandate, adapt what the Coast Guard ships are doing, it's all in the art of the possible. So we have the 16 vessels. We have the two AOPs that my colleague here just mentioned that were made in that same announcement, so 18 new ships. And then a couple months later, the government announced the money to replace six icebreakers. So that list of seven that you see, essentially six of them would be replaced. Now, just to be clear, that doesn't mean there's a downgrading. It's a bit of a mix of the, there's actually out of those seven, six of them are medium or heavy icebreakers. Those are the six. The seventh one would in fact fall under the replacement of those 16 multi-purpose vessels. So the multi-purpose vessels, just to be clear, will have icebreaking capability, light icebreaking capability. But at this point in time, we would envision in current climatic conditions an ability to operate in the summer months in the southern Arctic. And of course, as climate changes in the north, you know, where they may or may not be able to operate can evolve. So then the six program icebreakers would be used to do the clearing of the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes as we do in the winter months, and then would work and operate in the north in the summer months. And on top of all of that, we have $2 billion additional for vessel life extension for these ships and some others to get us over the hurdle of, you know, between now and the delivery of all of these ships. We have the investment, of course, but they're not built yet. And we also have the Polar class vessel, which is still on the docket and still funded and remains. So what all this adds up to really is a transformation of the Canadian Coast Guard fleet. We're very happy about, of course, being able to replace some of our older platforms to have something more reliable for delivering programs. But ultimately what we see is more capacity, more flexibility in the future. And maybe I'll just finish off by talking a little bit about the partnerships with the RCN. So we, you know, the AOPS is going to be an obvious one to everybody. We're, nevertheless, the ships are a bit different. They're going to be more the same than different. And so there's obvious, you know, synergies there between operations, maintenance, et cetera, that we're going to work on. But even in the immediate term, before that announcement was made, we'd already signed an agreement, a collaboration agreement with the Navy. The Navy had reached out to us wanting to learn some of that expertise. And in fact, some senior officers that are going to be commanding those first vessels have already sailed and spent the summers on board Coast Guard ships, learning from our captains and having the opportunity to sail in the Arctic. So I think there's going to be a lot more opportunity for synergy and collaboration moving forward, but it's already underway.
So to come back to the Canada-US focus for the conversation today, so both going forward with the new investments in the fleet, but also in the present tense, I'm going to ask both the Navy speakers on the podium to talk a little bit about how you see the relationship with our allies and other partners going forward. So for Second Fleet in particular, what's the thinking around how you're going to work? So you mentioned some of the other commands, I guess, facing mostly east. What do you envision as the relationship with NORAD and NORTHCOM? And then can you talk a little bit about how you would see the ongoing operation between the Canadian Navy and the American Navy and the other American Coast Guard to the extent that that's involved? In the past, we talked a lot about interoperability. Is interoperability still the correct paradigm? Because at least in the air context, there's more of a focus lately in talking about integration and working in an integrated rather than an interoperable environment. So what's the collaboration and the partnership piece?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dave. In fact, it's a topic that is quite timely as well. In fact, the language is changing. Interoperability had been the terminology, and we are talking more about integration. And when I speak about that, I'm speaking from the USN perspective, the narrative that I'm representing in working on in Second Fleet. No surprise that NATO is, of course, an interoperable organization, common processes, common operating procedures. With a very international presence. What's unique about Second Fleet is that as a core U.S. organization, it has an international presence embedded within as full exchange officers doing core work, not as liaison officers, but actually assigned portfolios within the fleet. I'm just one of those individuals. Norway is there, France is there, and the United Kingdom are there. So that's a manifestation in and of itself of integration when you're bringing in international partners into a core U.S. command. Because it's not simply about the equipment that transfers the zeros and the ones and the IT processes that allow that integration. It's the behavior. It's the how we operate. It's the different perspectives, which of course influence the culture of those organizations and how they work together. To the point about some of the domain awareness piece, I referred earlier to the fact that the NATO operational footprint disappeared in the 2000s from the Eastern Seaboard. And both Canada and the United States, from a maritime perspective, their focus was on overseas assignments, overseas missions, overseas wars. And so the operational perspective and thinking was, well, we can create operational effects for those overseas activities, but homeland defense from a maritime perspective was not an operational thought. That's changing. So Second Fleet now, after having achieved IOC last year with Baltops, 8,000 people, 50 ships, 18 countries, for Baltops on board Mount Whitney, no less, Sixth Fleet's command ship. And then a number of other activities last year with an international perspective, and whether it was an expeditionary operations center where we deployed it to Keflavik, Iceland, whether it was participating in Exercise Vigilant Shield from a homeland defense perspective, more on that in a second, or perhaps even more recently an actual operational response to competitor activity in the Atlantic theater of the likes that we haven't seen in some time. And so these are some examples that allowed us to confidently declare FOC, full operational capability of Second Fleet, just a few weeks ago. Again, small, lean, agile organization. But in terms of mindset, in terms of expeditionary maneuver capability, whether it's for the European theater, whether it's for the North American theater for those combatant commanders, but a return to viewing the Atlantic as a theater of operations, a seamless theater, a connection point between the two continents. Because it's no surprise that the combatant commanders, EUCOM, NORTHCOM, there's a dividing line between them. You know, those dividing lines where they split up the world is based on a thinking of, frankly, land and army geography. And that's a seam that can be exploited by competitors in the fluid nature that represents the Atlantic. So it's key to have an allied multinational perspective in responding to that, whether it's international partners integrated within the organization, or whether it's using operating principles that are founded, frankly, on NATO, recognizing that even the United States is actually a founding member of NATO. Notwithstanding the processes that have sometimes migrated away, it's a return now to operating principles that are more in tune from an integrated fashion. And to kind of land on your last piece about the homeland defense integration with NORTHCOM in particular, as an example, and I referred to Exercise Vigilant Shield, a homeland defense exercise, an important validation point for Second Fleet, operating as the maritime coordination element east for the Atlantic Theater, in support of the Maritime Component Commander, which is NAV North. This is Fleet Forces Command, which of course supports NORTHCOM in their homeland defense role. So a number of different ways of creating and implementing a command and control that focuses on mission, it focuses on a mission response to the threat, and it focuses on a maritime component to support either a combatant commander or a joint task force to ensure that the effects that we're trying to achieve in the maritime environment with an all-domain lens from the seabed through to space, at least in the maritime theater, is integrated within whatever the requirement is for NORTHCOM from a homeland defense perspective. And so we're using a number of resources to do that. Part of it is enhancing common operating picture between the United States and Norfolk, with Canada in Halifax, with Nuuk in Greenland, to make sure that Western Atlantic COP is understood, codified, shared, so that we can integrate the picture collectively and then, of course, use that information to our advantage. Because the Atlantic is, once again, a contested environment, and we're seeing that today.
So to pick up right on that last point that you mentioned about maintaining the common picture, So you had touched on this, Douglas, in terms of wanting to get away from the model of, you know, we build stuff once and then we come back in 20 years and then we upgrade it and then maybe you do it again, or then you get rid of it and get something new. And if there's actually a process that's set up to achieve that, that'd be great if you could set that up, because I'm always a little bit, people have talked about that a lot, but I've not yet seen a lot of evidence that there's actually going to be a construct that's going to allow that to happen. If that's the case, correct me. But it, on the connectivity piece and the common picture bit specifically, how are you approaching CSC in particular and the other projects to the extent that it's relevant? What are you trying to do at the front end to set up a dynamic where you're going to maintain consistent ability to have our ships work as seamlessly as possible with American ships, which would certainly seem to be driving towards an ever-increasing amount of commonality or the ability to view the exact same picture and then potentially act on it?
So, 2 weeks.
You haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what I'll say is that it has always been our aim to be, and I use the word interoperable, because in project world, as you guys all know, the words really do matter. So in our project definitions, we actually use interoperable. So I'm going to steer away from other nuanced language, and I'll stick with interoperable. We have always aimed as a Canadian fleet to be interoperable with our allies. United States has always been an extremely important ally to be interoperable with. And I think that would be the same for the Army and the Air Force. But I'm a Navy guy, so I know for the Navy that that is very important. It's also very important for us to be interoperable with our NATO allies, and also with other members of like-minded states and the communities that tend to form coalitions. But when it comes down to how, if I look at the future and I look at the ship that we're going to be getting and envisage how is that interoperability going to improve, I would say it's going to improve dramatically from what we've seen in the Halifax class. Again, it's a more modern ship. It's going to have much more technology in it, but it's also going to have a lot of American technology that is currently fielded in the American fleet. They are kind enough to allow us to use their stuff. The idea of us using their stuff is, of course, that we can be interoperable with them and possibly even lead in coalitions. And we can deploy and then more seamlessly integrate, I'll use the word, with their fleets when we have to. Now, I did that years ago on a Halifax class with an aircraft carrier group with an XO who was Buck's Wick. It's been done. Actually, I think you came later. But anyway, it's been done, but maybe not as well as it will be done in the future. So how do we constantly revisit it? With the shipbuilding program as we're looking at it now, with the CSCs being built every 1 to 2 years going out, I'm sure there is going to be lessons learned. Actually, I know there will be lessons learned from first of class for all the vessels on what you have to do in order to capture those lessons learned so that as the next ones come out, that we technologically make sure that we're able to do this, but also as we experience these ships with the Americans, and we'll stick with the North American context, with the Americans, we will improve our procedures, because in the end, it's how the people end up working together. We sometimes fight the systems. We hope the systems will aid us, but it's really how the people and the constant working together that will allow us to be able to, and I'll use the integrate word again, integrate with each other and continue to be completely interoperable. Just have to end on that one.
Good segue. So as I'm going to invite anybody that wants to ask a question to make their way to the mic, and I'm going to come back to John. There's a lot of conversation earlier in the day about different aspects of hybrid or gray zone, or pick your flavor, describing that new type of activity below the threshold of conflict. Less of it has been in an explicitly maritime context, although we were talking earlier about the interest that some other countries have in conducting science around North America. What are the hybrid types of activity that you see from your organization, and what do you think are the particular types of challenges that those would pose in this discussion?
Yeah, so I think it's important that when we look at Russia and China, they're not the same communist countries we always thought they were and never were. You know, Russia's edict is to destroy us. China's edict is to own us, and that's both Canada and the U.S. The Russians have had a program called Maskarovka for a couple hundred years where it's sometimes veiled or loosely translated as denial and deception. You know, put a canvas or blow up a submarine balloon or to counter targeting. But in reality, they go one step further and they're trying to make us who have collected against them think, ah, we know what they're doing, like maybe a presidential election cyber thing. And we think, oh, they're trying to put this person into power, when in reality, they're trying to do something completely different that we're not thinking about that. So when you think of gray zone, where they're exploiting things like law or lack of the law so that they can conduct hybrid, asymmetric, I mean, these terms have been around for a year. Sun Tzu talked about some of this in his Chinese Art of War philosophy. Mm-hmm. And when we look at it from a maritime, they're taking a look at like illegal fishing. It's a really big thing both in Canada and the United States right now. In fact, the U.S. Coast Guard Commandant made that one of his three top priorities was IUUF, illegal, unrestricted, and unregulated fishing. And people go, well, why? How does that really matter? Well, it matters that some estimates that by the year 2030, we will not have maritime protein. So imagine us having lunch today and not having that beautiful fish. Instead, maybe it's a mushroom or something like that, or just beer. But I had to throw that in, being a former Navy.
Not yet,
guy.
Soon.
But the point is I think it's important that when we look at hybrid warfare, is actually operating in those gray zones, and when we talk about whether it's an illegal fishing operation, that is also a covert cover for intel collection. Or they're putting intel operatives, you know, into our countries that way, because we can't monitor those. That ship I talked about had actually received five different loads of drugs on its way from Peru to Philadelphia. And so how do we monitor that? And I'm really, you know, really the Canadian Coast Guard and the Canadian Navy have great sensors that we can share along those lines. We have some partnerships that will help us with some of that gray zone. We have my organization works with NORAD, NIMIO, and Transport Canada. And we also have responses that in part can react to those so we don't go to full out war. The MOTR is the Maritime Operational Threat Response, and Canada has MERP, which is the MOTR Event Response Protocol. And those are designed to who will take charge of an event. So the big one was the Myers pirate event off of Somalia. If you saw the movie, Captain Phillips and Fleet Forces Command was providing the intel. Somebody has to take control of that. And so when we have these gray zone or hybrid events that are occurring, A, we have to understand that our adversary, and I'll take the Russians, because I remember giving a presentation on how the Soviet Navy was going to take out one aircraft carrier. And for our weapon systems, they're point defense. We're going to take out command control, we'll take out the weapons, take the whatever. They were going to launch 30 different weapons against a Forrestal class aircraft carrier. And those weapons would come from the air, they would come from ship-based missiles, and they would come from torpedoes, and then later submarine launched weapons. And those torpedoes were also both surface and subsurface. 30 weapons to get a 30% kill. So when you look at them attacking North Defense, they're not going to rely on a singular threat. And I'm very encouraged to hear a lot of people talking about that today. But sometimes the maritime gets minimized, right? And you have to understand that that is the area of ungoverned spaces that we have to be most aware of. And so the gray zone and the hybrid warfare coming on our shores, I think, is really, really huge, and we can't discount it. And when you have precious dollars, so you're going to buy a new radar system Or are you going to give the Canadian Navy a new ship? Or, you know, okay, we're going to give you a new ship, but we're going to take that Spy 7 and not put it on there. We're going to give you, you know, a pair of binoculars, which in some cases might be a better sensor. Not against the Spy 7, it's just the human eyeball can see things and react things different than, you know, we look at what the Vincennes did against an Iranian aircraft, and we understand that sometimes sensor to shooter still always needs a human being. So that's a long answer to a question. I hope I answered that for you, sir.
Absolutely. We'll take a couple questions from the floor.
So my name is Pierre LeBlanc. I'm with Arctic Security Consultants. The ability to do maritime domain awareness in the Arctic has improved significantly over the last 20 years. What I would like to do is maybe go one point further than John has mentioned earlier. Once you have identified a rogue vessel that is seen as a security threat, I was wondering if the panelists could talk about Canada's ability to do an opposed boarding of that vessel up in the Arctic.
Which one of you would like to answer that question?
I can speak to a piece of it, Pierre. So I think if we talk about capabilities, I'll come back to Coast Guard assets. That being said, we wouldn't have a mandate to do that, but many other federal partners may, depending on the angle that you wanted to take. So I would suspect that we actually are fairly well prepared. That being said, as you well know, the Arctic is a vast area, and you know, we see in search and rescue cases, you can look on a map that there's an incident here and our ship's right here, and it looks like, well, great, that's right next door. They'll be there in an hour or two. Well, 48 hours later, right? And so that's the actual reality. So aside from that, which I think any innumerable amount of assets up there isn't going to resolve that space issue. That being said, there are entrances to come into northern Canada, right? And you can't, like, there aren't multiple ways in and out. So I would say that overall, certainly we have the assets to support that kind of thing, but it would ultimately be up to other partners to enforce their mandates based on wanting to board a vessel.
Nothing from your 2 weeks? John.
So I have a different response to that, and I would say that one of the things that we're doing with both of our countries, but within our countries, we have authorities that are the intel community, defense, law enforcement, and then there's some other authorities that don't always mesh and we can't always share that data. We have to come up with ways, and we are coming up with ways, whether they're through a common MDA tool for ship tracking or the COP, as you've heard, common operating picture. But I think that's an important thing that we can do very easily with a policy change to share that information so that we have a complete picture so we can give the decision makers that opportunity. It also gives the lawyers. How many lawyers are in the room? Yeah, so It's great that you're here.
More than I would have guessed.
Because we often forget to ask you the question, can we do that? And I think with some of the authorities that the Coast Guard has, as in our U.S. Coast Guard, those authorities exist. But we have to give them the information so that the boarding is conducted in a legal manner with probable cause, not just because they're Russian and they're on an oligarch's yacht that maybe was collecting against, you know, UK submarines, you know, 6 weeks earlier, and now they're off of, you know, one of your bases. But we have to share that information. So I would just throw that in there too.
Rob Hubert, last question.
Thank you. Okay, so this morning we've heard hypersonics are becoming much quicker, more numerous. We've heard the growing threat from Russia and from China. We've heard from Jody that the Arctic is going to be a central location. We've now just heard, of course, is this rebirth of the Canadian fleet, which I applaud on both the Coast Guard and the Navy side. My specific question is, when we look into the future of what is just being outlined to us in the threat environment, what are we doing in terms of the new Coast Guard vessels? What are we doing in terms of the AOPS to play this role in terms of the intelligence and the domain awareness? In other words, do we have the capacity to utilize these vessels in some form of detection for these new missile systems? And in terms of the subsurface threat that seems many are now starting to talk about growing, how do we square the circle? The Canadian surface combatant won't be ice capable, but they'll have anti-submarine capabilities. The AOPS are ice capable, but don't have anti-submarine capabilities. So looking into the future, how do we square these circles?
Okay, we'll start squaring circles, starting with John, and work our way this way.
Well, I'm not operationally capable to answer that question, but I will tell you, in the United States, they have created a new term of underseas to seabed, in which they're looking at other ways of looking at under the water, not just submarine, because there's a lot of things on there, whether it's economic. And I believe the technologies of UUVs, unmanned vehicles that are underwater, will help take some of the detection capabilities of those.
It's a great question. I don't have an answer.
Next week you'd have
it. Maybe next week. But no, in all honesty, I don't have an answer because, first of all, what my role is to get the ships that we have out the door, like get the ones that we have designed out the door. How those will be used by the Navy, I can say that what we do with the Halifax class, and indeed what we do with the MCDV, the Kingston class, is far more than what we thought we would do with them when those were put on paper. So do I envisage that we will be doing things with the Joint Support Ship, the Arctic Offshore Patrol Ship, and the Canadian Surface Combatant that is beyond what we foresee right now? Yes. So the squaring of that circle is going to be done by the entire organization. And I'm not just talking about Department of National Defense. The Government of Canada will come up with how these things can be done. And as we continue to work in concert with the Coast Guard and all these and the other government departments, we will be able to square that circle. But will it be perfect? No. So that's my answer.
Maybe two different pieces that I can speak about, Rob. I think in both cases we're thinking about this stuff. We're not anywhere close to, you know, having arrived at the answer. So I guess, first of all, when we talk about threat detection, you know, as I explained earlier, from a Coast Guard side, you know, any response after is kind of out of our bailiwick. But, you know, are ships the right way to be detecting? Is it our shore-based infrastructure and using our MCTS center in Iqaluit? Is it space-based? It's probably a combination of all the above, and I would argue that, you know, something I forgot to mention earlier, is that we are partnering with Inuit, in fact, who are installing their own AIS and kind of working with them, and also the use of Inuit hunters. So it kind of goes all the way from, you know, a satellite down to an Inuit hunter who's actually out on the water, who can see the vessel, who copies down information, sends it into the center, right? So there's probably some combination of all of the above, and I think as Mike spoke about earlier from the defense, you know, one of the challenges is that D&D, Coast Guard, Transport Canada, and others, Inuit organizations, we all have to come together and make sure we're working in partnership. And that's just domestically, before we get into, you know, how do we interoperate with the U.S., with Greenland and the Danish Defense Forces. And we're working very closely with, and I know the military as well, both the Danish Defense Forces and the U.S. Coast Guard in our case, U.S. military, I guess, in yours. So I think that's one of the areas. And then the other piece is on the AOPS. So again, the announcement only just happened. However, we do recognize an opportunity between the Navy and the Coast Guard. What that means and how it all plays out remains to be determined, but there's certainly an opportunity there for us.
Last word.
So I think the key is not thinking of it from a traditional perspective of a singular platform and the capabilities that that individual platform would have. It starts with interoperable capabilities. It manifests itself through an integrated operating picture that's created from a variety of sources, both nationally, number of partners nationally, and internationally through whether it's Denmark, whether it's the United States, whether it's Canada. And then finally, bringing that together through the partnerships that are enabled with the common mission set. And the mission set is homeland defense. And when you frame it as a mission set in that perspective, and you leverage the partnerships in the integrated fashion by which you either create your common picture or you bring those people together in an integrated fashion, and then of course you rely on the interoperable capabilities that have been put through in design, I think when you bring that together, you're going to find the solution space to deal with the threat, however it manifests itself. But we need to have the aperture a little wider than focused on a singular platform and a singular platform to respond to any particular threat. But a lot of that is constrained by previous practice, previous behavior. It's influenced our culture. And I think that we need to, again, widen that aperture and making sure that we're relying on each other and not looking for individual, internal, singular national solutions. We need to be thinking of it from a wider perspective.
Okay, I think that's a great note to end on, a discussion about the continental cooperation. With that, everyone join me in thanking the panel.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Today you were listening to a recording from our Modernizing North American Defense Conference. Thank you to the Department of National Defense's Minds program for making this conference possible. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment in your podcast app. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer Jay Rankin and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.